Welcome to Big Blend Radio's art show featuring Victoria Chick, a contemporary figurative artist and early 19th and 20th century print collector. Welcome, everybody. Today, we are excited to talk about the art of engraving, which is pretty interesting when you think about engraving. Nancy and I recently went to Two Trees Distilling with our friend Steve and Karen, who run the Lion and the Rose Bed and Breakfast in Asheville, North Carolina. We do a show with them. And we went to Two Trees Distilling. Joe was on our show talking about their whiskeys and bourbons. And he says, well, when you come back to Asheville, you need to come. And we're like, all right, we'll come do a podcast on tasting, which we did. It was fun. Victoria knows we like bourbon, whiskey, wine, all those good things in life. And what we found out is their newest thing is that they are doing engravings on glass, on bottles, and artwork can be done. And then I thought, wow, we're going to be talking about the art of engraving with Victoria. And now it's like really interesting to see this huge machine that they have and how they can do it on different bottles and different things, depending on how the art is turned in. And now I'm going, where did the history start with this? Because they didn't have these machines way back when, right? Victoria, welcome back. How are you?
Oh, thank you, Lisa. Yeah, they didn't have those machines way back then. And yes, I'm doing really well. And I'm glad to be able to talk about this with you. It's interesting that they're using glass. I've heard of etching glass before, but I haven't heard of engraving glass. So that's a process that I don't know about.
Yeah, it's interesting because people, you know, they have their bottles of bourbon and they're flat. Very good bourbon, yeah. By the way, and whiskey. And
yeah,
so what great. They do is they engrave like a logo if somebody wants something special, or like if it's a wedding or something. But like we've had glasses with a map of Tucson and the map of Arizona wrapped around them. And you can actually feel it. Yeah. So it is digging into the glass. So now maybe everyone's saying engraving versus etching.
Yeah. No. Well, you know, I don't know. With modern things, sometimes people borrow words, but that doesn't mean, you know, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. So, but what they're doing is probably akin to really ancient times when they weren't printed on paper, you know, the engraving or etching or whatever process they were using wasn't printed on paper to be sold. It was just into the metal, or in this case, they're doing a process that makes indentations in the glass. Mm-hmm. And I'm not familiar with the engraving aspect of that. But back when in the Middle Ages, when people were wearing armor a lot more than they do now, they did use an engraving process because these knights and so forth that wore the armor wanted to have them decorated, and they were so what they would do, it was the armorers would put some designs on. They were pretty skilled, but they weren't quite as skilled at that delicate kind of work as jewelers were. So eventually jewelers sort of took over the work of being engravers because they were used to working with metal. And I did one engraving in my lifetime back at college. It was very difficult medium because it requires so much control and so much strength to push this V-shaped gouge, tiny V-shaped gouge through metal, like we're making a furrow.
Yeah.
For somebody who is 19 years old, it was not easy. And in fact, it was kind of frustrating because I had seen good engravings, and mine certainly did not measure up to them. So I did not pursue engraving, But it's a really, really interesting topic, like you say. And every time I see engravings from the past, especially, I'm amazed, really amazed at the detail and the ability to make the shapes, but make the illusion of three dimensions, you know, with shading and cross hatching and all the elements that go into 3D work on a
It is
2D
pretty
surface.
incredible because now, we've
Yeah.
got computers working and AI. Here comes the world of
Yes.
AI, which I don't even get into that. On, just like I've looked at a, artificial intelligence art, and there's just no soul to it. It just seems so flat and like dead
Yeah.
and perfect. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not, it's just, there's nothing messy or emotion. And I don't know. It just sucks to me. That's my opinion.
Well, yeah,
And that doesn't
right. I
mean
mean,
it's
you,
right.
yeah,
It just,
it's you. It will appeal. It would appeal to somebody who's detail oriented and information oriented. I think people who are very expressive or really like a loose kind of connection there to what is in the art are not going to be really attracted to it, you know. But
No.
there'll be a market. There'll be a market for it because it's
Yeah.
new and because it's different, and people like new and different things.
It's going to be in those houses that everything's so over contemporary and cold. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like contemporary is fine. I'm into that. But then there's
Yeah.
that side where they step into like it's almost too like, I know here we run magazines, but we have warmth in our magazines. We're a little different, but there's those ones that are just everything is so cold. And then it's like, okay, in real estate, do you want it to be that cold? Maybe they do. Yes, they do. And so it's kind of a very interesting thing of happening. But I find, and I brought it up because engraving is interesting with that because of having this exactness, using computers like what they're doing with this engraving on glass. It's like, if you're doing someone's logo, you need to replicate that logo. And when we were talking to them, and they were at the very beginning of this newer technology, and they're like, "Well, we're going to be messing with this for a couple of weeks." And obviously, they're looking at the holiday season, and everything. But
Sure.
if it's something for weddings, they do the engraving on glass, glasses like champagne glasses. But
Sure.
sometimes it's not actually getting into the glass. You know what I mean? So it's kind of this intro. It's I don't know how to explain it,
Do
but it's not.
you tell me something about it? Let me ask you a couple of questions because you've seen this and I assume you've held these things like the glasses, and if you run your fingers across them. Is there a slight roughness?
Indentation. Yeah, there's a roughness and an indentation. So they're actually
Okay.
engraving on glass,
Because
because it's
there's
on
two
their
things.
bottles, and they can do it on
Yeah.
coasters. So not just glass,
Yeah.
like they have wooden coasters that they engrave on it, and then so when the where the like if it's wooden or like cork or something, so it's light,
Yeah.
and where they engrave on it is an indentation, and it's a dark brown because that's
Okay.
so this whatever they're doing with this machine is doing like exact replications, but you have to know your
Sure.
material, you have to
Yeah.
under, it's just like printing. It's like, I look at what we used to do with printing the magazine, but it was topical, right? So it wasn't
Yeah.
in indenting at all, but it
Yeah,
like it had
it
the
was a surface,
it
yeah.
yeah. So the first batch of magazines would go out, they would start tightening up the stretch on the actual printing machine, right? And so it
Yes.
was like, oh, you finally honed it down to its exact as best you can. Because you're putting all this full color ink and all these different plates are doing all this. And I mean, when we were printing back in the day, we were typesetting and printing. And now we're,
Yeah.
everything's going from on a computer image right to a printing press, which didn't exist
Right.
when we first started. So that's how young Nancy and I are. And then you go from the process of film and all of that has changed. But the one thing stays the same. The amount of ink going onto the press, it means how much is this paper? You like there's a art to how much ink is going on the stretching of the paper so the ink doesn't roll off. There's a soaking, you know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And
Yes.
then, and you dry it. So when you get it honed in, it's like awesome. Well, 20, 30,000 down the line, everything starts to go, screw you. I'm tired of stretching my stretch, you know, because you're still dealing with this. It's still malleable. Paper is, it's organic, right? So
Yeah, right.
going to glass, which is organic, but if they get glass that is a little thicker than before or a little thinner, whatever they're
Right.
doing in engraving is going to change. So that's interesting to me because it's,
Yeah.
and then going back to history with you guys talking about these guys with the metal and these engravers and jewelers, how they did it without the precision of computers is beyond my mind. It's beyond my mind.
Right. Yeah, I know. I know what exactly what you mean. Because it is amazing, and as I say, I tried it, and I'm even more amazed that they were so good. Oh golly! Now, what you mentioned about the glass. One other technique that is done with glass is sandblasting, and that's changed too because of computer ability. That the energy of the sand or the grit hitting the glass carves it out, but it's so much more precise because of the computers. An edge is the true edge. It's not the etching doesn't sort of bleed into the glass that you want to be remain smooth. So that's another interesting technique.
Wow.
When we
Well,
talk when
now
we
I
talk about
wonder, I just want to touch on this. Like, you know, we talk about AI, but what about 3D printing? It's kind of like the opposite of engraving because it's building instead of indenting. It's kind of like this. Here we've got 3D, and 3D printing to me is weird. I mean, they're making hamburgers out of 3D
3D,
printing.
3D, 3D, 3D printing is like sculpture.
Yeah,
It's
it's like the
different. It's di
opposite.
it's different. It's different than engraving. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a
Yeah.
complete opposite, you know? And so
Right.
engrave, are they doing it backwards? Like, not like, are they flipping it? So, like, if you're engraving a cow and the artist said, here's my cow, and you know, the cow is the face is pointing to the right and the body is going to the left, right? So butt to the left,
Okay.
face to the right. Now, when they engrave it,
Yeah.
are they flipping it and doing the face to the left and the butt to the right?
No. What you, it's no diff it's wait a second. Wait a second. It's no different in the actual printing process. It's no different than any other printing process. You're going to get a reverse image. When you pull the paper, it'll be a reverse image of
Oh,
what you
wow.
thought you had. See, so
I
but I
like that
don't
you said
think
what you
it,
thought you had.
yeah, so anyway, printing is different. You usually have to think in reverse because you're going to get a reverse image of from what is on the plate as after it goes through the press, because you've put your paper down and now you pull it off, and what was facing left is now facing right.
Okay.
So,
Okay.
anyway.
Okay. So yeah, that's what I was saying. It's going to be reversed,
Yeah.
but so basically whatever the artist does is going to be in reverse, and the artist, if they know they're going to have it engraved, has to think in an opposite mind. Like you have to
Well,
use both sides of your brain big time.
right. And he might be able to, he might be able to do that, I mean, you see buildings and he, people, one of the reasons that engravings sort of blossomed in the whole like 17th, 18th and 19th centuries is because people were traveling more. They would go places and they wanted a souvenir and they couldn't afford a painting. So, these engravings became very popular because they would see a work by a famous artist, and then this engraver would come along and he would copy that. image, and sell it for a much reduced price. So the people were really happy. They had the image they wanted, not in color, but it was a reminder of their trip, which people will always visit souvenir shops, and they said they wanted souvenirs in the Baroque and classical era.
Okay,
So
I
those
gotta go
the
backwards.
engravings served a purpose besides being, really nice art themselves.
So I have to go back. So the engravings were first on armor and metal and things, right? Then at one point, history said, okay, we are going to, it's almost like creating a mold, right? For the ink to run into the engraving and then it goes on paper, or is it?
Lisa, it's a good question, and it started off very simply because the people that were doing the armor wanted to keep a record of what they had done because this customer might come back and want the same kind of design on the next piece of armor that he had. So what they would do is they would just take a piece of paper. Well, it wasn't the kind of paper we think of as paper today. It was much probably more like some kind of skin, like a vellum. And they would ink the armor, and then they would press this paper against it, and the ink would come off on the paper. So it was just kind of a fragment of what their whole design was, but it was enough for them to keep a record of it. And that's how the idea of transferring the design with ink started. And that continued probably until the 1600s, when somebody came up with a bright idea, a jeweler probably, at the request of an artist to do an engraving of his painting or an engraving of his drawing. And then they started selling those as artworks themselves. So it was no longer considered a record so much as it was a piece of artwork.
Okay, wow. So when you think about, so it becomes an artwork. So at that point, that's how this whole process of artists being able to reproduce their art. So when you were talking about people seeing, tourists seeing these amazing buildings and getting that engraved piece, that's where I was going
Sure.
like, hey, they're getting this engraved piece, but was it on metal, like on a trinket, which you can get these days, right? Or was it like
Right.
as a print. So you said they weren't in full color at that point. At that point, it was like black and white or whatever the ink color was.
It was just black and white. And sometimes they would, call, well, a little bit later on, the engravers got sort of set up their own business because tourism started being a much bigger thing in the 17th and 18th centuries. And people, like you say, they wanted a souvenir. And so the engravers would not wait to be commissioned by the artist to do a picture of their or an engraving of their work or their pictures. They would just go into business for themselves and start. They would go to a museum, say, and they would copy a famous artist's artwork, and they would sell that. But they still, I think it's interesting, they still would not claim credit for it. They would say this is an Albrecht Dürer engraving, but Albrecht Dürer had just been copied by this guy who was an engraver,
Wow.
I think that's an offshoot of what happened early on when artists would ask an engraver to do work on with their design or their picture. And they were never credited with it because their work was considered menial, a menial task, which is really funny because it was certainly something that required an amazing amount of skill. It was not the same. I mean, ditch diggers were menial tasks, and engravers were considered in the same category, which is hard for us to understand. That's just the way it was back in the 1600s. So I think now you if you were going to go out and look at look at an art gallery, you'd see lots of engravings. And what you see in a gallery might be something that the artist has commissioned somebody else to do and under his name. And it might be a reproduction much later and will still be called by the name of the artist, the original artist. So it's very difficult because way back until the 20th century, really, artists did not sign their work in pencil underneath the picture, which they did started doing that in just in the 20th century. And when the artist has signed in pencil, you know that he actually put his hand to it. He was actually involved. If you're looking, you might be looking at a picture that doesn't have that, say of, and I'm using Albrecht Dürer as an example. There were all kinds of other ones. If at that time they weren't signing, so you don't know exactly when that engraving was done. So, I mean, the artist may have been dead for 200 years, and you don't know that. I mean, and they still are valuable. They really are. It's just they're just not as valuable as something that you can trace the ownership of it. Probably is the best way to do that. Trace the ownership of ship back to when the last owner, first owner, excuse me, bought it directly from the artist. So it's still possible to do that.
It's really fascinating to me because it's kind of like a copycat thing in a way, right? And
In a
yet
way,
now,
yeah.
then you get artists who go, "Ooh, I see. I can be, look at Ted DeGrazia. We always talk about, him being one of the most reproduced artists in the world. He went, you know what? I know how to make, art for the masses." And he had like a collective of people copying his art. And then reproducing it in different ways on textiles, on everything. So, some artists were like, "Hey, I know how to survive and make money." Some were capitalistic, and what's wrong with that? And, each to their own.
Yes, there's nothing wrong with it as long as people understand what they're buying. And with Ted, they know, and with Ted, he's probably authorized it because he
Oh,
wants
well.
people to,
Yeah, you're really
and people
right.
who authorize, you ought to, you by authorizing, you ought to be able to get a part of what it brings,
Well,
essentially, which is a lot like,
Glance at DeGrazia Gallery in the Sun. Most of his day is spent answering people going, "That's not an original. This is. That's a print. That's a copy," because people don't know the difference
no,
if it's
and it's good
framed.
that he can do that.
Yeah, that's most of his day, and they have a consignment room in the gallery of where if someone's, doing an estate sale or something, they try to get as much of the original art back actually, and purchase it or put it on consignment and help them sell it. So at least it's in its correct place to do it with the correct information. But yeah, because DeGrazia did stuff. I mean, he would sit and he'd go to a bar and scribble on a piece of paper and sell it for $5 for a drink or whatever, so you never, yeah, so it's an original when he does that. But when it's like something from an
it is.
engraved, yeah, so when they do engravings and then that becomes a mainstream, does that get like numbered like a print would be numbered? Like, because it is still a print from an
No,
engraving.
they didn't do that. And
Ooh, that's hard.
what you see, I mean, and you've got to figure it's the 16th or even the 17th century. Who's going to know who they're, who how far out their prints are going to be sold? So most of the people that they're very provincial when they're marketing. Their marketing is provincial. People come to them from another country maybe, but the locals know. I mean, it was so simple back then. One of the things you see today, and I notice it particularly because I'm a collector, And I look at a lot of auction possibilities. A lot of auction send me catalogs every day online, and I sift through them. I mean, sometimes I'll get four and five in one day from different auction houses, and I look through them. You can see what's coming up for sale and how it's described, which is really interesting. You can see a picture of it, so you have an idea of what it is. But so many items or I mean, are they'll list the artist that the original artist that did the design, the picture, and they'll, if they're honest, which most auction houses are, they'll say like Picasso, or they'll have Picasso in big letters, and there were, and then in small letters they'll have after, AFTER, and that means somebody has taken Picasso's picture and made a reproduction, basically. And
Okay.
people that don't know better think they're getting a Picasso original.
Oh.
Gosh, I've got something that was done by Picasso, and that's okay. What, maybe they just like the picture. They are intrigued by the design. They like the colors. It goes over their sofa really well, and it fits in their house, and they're happy with it. And it's just that when you see something like a Picasso that's for sale for $54 and a starting bid, you know that something is not kosher here. So you know you're not getting an original. You know, you should know that. So,
Wow.
but there's a
So
lot of that goes.
this is really
And
hard for collectors to know it. Like, you're gonna have to do some
it,
research.
well, if you're a collector, if you've collected for a while, you come to realize what's good and what isn't. Or not, I should say good. What's legitimate? If they're calling it a legitimate description, if they're making something out of it that you know can't be true. I mean, Picasso's sell for hundreds of thousands of dollars, and when you get one for 54, you know something's not right. So you have you can you learn you learn to be suspicious, and you learn to be canny in what you're seeing, and to sift through it before you buy. But I mean, there's an, it depends what your goal is. If you're trying to collect something that has a value because it was made by an artist whose work you respect, that's different than just wanting to decorate a room in your
Right.
house. So, and
Exactly.
either one of the, I mean, each one is legitimate for that person, but they just need to know what the differences are, so they're not being cheated.
Wow. So it's just
Or they're not,
really
they're,
getting, yeah.
yeah. And that's, it's more like they're cheating. Well, I shouldn't say they're cheating themselves, because the auction houses will put clues on there that tell you what it is, just like putting the word after on there. But you have to know what it means. So
So,
anyway,
yeah. So that becomes,
we're
but
kind
that's
of,
part of collecting is that fascination and
yeah.
this backstory and the interest. Sometimes you're just, taken by an image and other people may not be taken
Yeah.
by it, but you are. And then you find
Sure.
out this crazy backstory. You know all about
Yeah.
that, don't you?
Well, there's it's and it's hard to tell online. I mean, if you can go to an auction, you can see things close up, and it, like we've talked about before, when you go to a museum or a gallery, you have an entirely different sensation when you look at a piece of artwork in directly, rather than you look at it in a book or online or whatever, in a movie, because you could pick up so much more information from an actual thing right in front of you than you can when you're being separated by film and different reproduction techniques and processes that go into making books. So there's nothing that replaces seeing things in person, really. And that's very basic. That's very basic. Even for me, which and I don't know everything. I know a lot just from being, I've made mistakes in my collecting. It took me a while to understand all the ins and outs and what is legitimate and what isn't.
Yeah, but you know, I don't call them mistakes because that's how you learn, right? But
Sure.
if you
Yeah.
liked
Right.
it, you liked it, unless you were just doing it for, you know,
Yeah.
just if you're collecting for financial reasons and you make a
Yeah.
mistake, well, then that sucks. But if
Yeah.
you're collecting for both, then you go, hey, you know, I like it, you
Yeah.
know.
Yeah.
So
Yeah. Right.
that's
And yeah, I don't collect for financial reasons. I probably more collect for historical reasons because I like looking at art of the past and what went into it and so forth and what it meant to the people at the time I mean you learn so much from art. You learn, I mean, even geography you can learn from art, from or sometimes even, you know, closer up, even math you can learn because the early artists used mathematical formulae in design, in their designing. So there's all kinds of things that that a person can glean from almost any artwork, almost anyone.
That's
And
interesting.
that goes to where, I mean, there's just because something is old doesn't mean it's valuable either. So it might be valuable to you because of the curiosity and you find it interesting. So I mean, everybody is different in what they like, what they decide to collect or not. So anyway.
Well, and yeah, I mean, well, because I think the whole collecting thing is interesting because it's, well, I know you're working on the museum, right? And so
Right.
a lot of times these, you know, engravings and prints from engravings become part of a collection. And people that do collect, sometimes that's a source of collecting and income and capitalism. And then sometimes it's like saving for history. And the people
Yeah.
you've collected, I mean, we've ended up doing stories on, it's like, they would have been under the radar if you didn't get it and write an article and come on a podcast. Like, we would never know.
Yeah,
You
yeah,
know what I mean? You've had to
yeah.
do digging on some of these people. And I just think, you know, some artists of the past, and they were prolific, but they just get swept up under the rug for all kinds of reasons, you know?
Well, yeah,
And
I mean, yes, exactly. There's so many things I've always collect because I have a reaction that to a piece that I see and I think, oh, that is really neat. I really like that. I think I'll get it, you know. And I don't know anything about the artist. I'm just reacting to the artwork. And for me, that's the most important thing about it. Some people collect because, well, because there's a historical rationale for people who collect art. Because they think it's going to appreciate it, so they're buying it now for a certain price, and you know they're gambling basically like a stock market that in 10 or 20 years it's going to double. So there are people that do collect for that reason, and usually they're collecting names of artists that are hot at a particular period of time when they're in search of something to buy, and sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't. As far as appreciation goes in value. And it's just, I mean, if that's their only thing, if that's their only reason that they bought something and it doesn't appreciate, now they're got a painting that they don't especially like. And maybe and it doesn't have the value if they want when they want to sell it, because they probably will want to sell it. It's just like people sell stocks or trade stocks. It's not it I you know their reason for collecting to me is not great. But then again, I mean, those people that do that probably have enough funds to not worry about it not appreciating.
Okay, so what about monoprinting? Isn't that kind of a form of engraving? Remember, we saw that at that one gallery. You gave us a demonstration of it. It was back in the days when the gallery was in Hurley.
Well, I remember that experience of monoprinting, and monoprinting it's always on top. It's always on the surface of the paper, so it doesn't go in into the paper. Well, in a physical way, other than absorption. Okay, so it's a little different, but. I think one of the things that we've also talked about in relationship to that is the progression of printmaking, I guess we'll call it, from first, like the armor that we talked about, just recording the design, to actually thinking of the work that's done on metal and printed as engraving, and engraving is also a term for the printing process. So it's used in a number of ways. And we know about other printing stuff. I mean, because I collect prints, and we've talked about them so many times. But there's woodblocks, there's etching, there's lithography. I mean, all kinds of printmaking processes, and probably engraving was the first one, because we originally had like people would incise on clay, meaning they just kind of make a depression in the clay, and sometimes it's fired, sometimes it's not. They never called it engraving, but
Oh.
was a process. It was a process that was different. It was a design process. Woodblock was early. I would say wood, I mean, there were woodblocks in the 15th, definitely the 16th. There's not a lot of them floating around, because they're probably all in museums or libraries. And they were used to illustrate Bibles. They were used to illustrate other things. Bibles especially, and they would be just probably little 2-inch square drawings, designs that would illustrate what was going on in the scripture at the time, in the place of the Bible. So I think it's interesting that all these processes are still being used. I mean, it's
Yeah.
not that you. Not like you had to go from, you not like you had to go from one to the other, like an automobile manufacturer, where you have a simple engine, two cylinders, and you go to four, then you go to eight and everything, and now nobody wants a two-cylinder engine. So it was that it's the market for all kinds of engraving, all kinds of graphic techniques that are still there. And are still interesting, and still, if you're an artist, you're probably going to prefer one more than the other, but because each one of these has a different set of skills and thing, yeah. So
I agree with you. I think it's fascinating, and at the same time, I have to bring this up because you mentioned clay, and then I think of stone and the engraving. Tombstones, that's a whole other topic. Tombstone art. I want to do something on that so bad because I find
Okay,
it
well, let's
fascinating
do
because
it.
there's sculptures and there's art with it. There's the process of the written word. I mean, sometimes, it just, I love going to graveyards. I'm not weird, but it is a form of engraving, and historians do that. They go and make print, like they use like a penny or whatever. And as kids, we did that where you did a like a relief. You'd go put a piece of paper over the tombstone and take a pencil and things like that, and then you'd get what was written because sometimes they get so worn out that the tombstone is you can't read it. So that's a whole
You're
other
right.
thing,
Well, that's a topic that would be fun to do, I think. I've always liked cemeteries because they're full of really interesting information for one thing, and you can see, you can see not only personal history a little bit, but you can see history of communities. We've got a cemetery just probably 7 miles away from where I live right now. It's abandoned now, and the town is abandoned. But in the you go visit their cemetery, and it's all these children's tombstones. And
Oh.
because there was a terrible plague of smallpox that came through in the 18 probably 1880s, and just about wiped out the town. So there's you see personal stuff, and then you realize what you're seeing in a bigger picture, and you realize it was a community-wide event here, and you can see the evidence of it.
But
So
don't start me on graveyards because that's a whole other hour. But we have been to Willcox, Arizona, down the road from you, the graveyard where Wyatt Earp's brother was buried after being in a brawl at which I think is a tasting winery tasting downtown and got shot. And people were walking over him while his dead body, walking over him to get into the store at the time back in the 1800s, and then we went to his tombstone, and then we were looking at someone else's, and a snake came out. I find snakes in graveyards everywhere, and it's like we've now decided that graveyards actually are part of our park tour, our Love Your Parks tour, because they are resting spaces. They're quiet, they're peaceful, they're a place for wildlife, including snakes. And people that I know, family has, and they're preserving history, but they are in just as much need as our parks in regards to funding and being maintained. And so sometimes master gardeners will go in and take care of the plots. Plots are still being discovered. Now we have laser technology that helps find plots and tombstones that are underground, depending, like if you're in Louisiana, they put you above because you can be floating down. There's all kinds of, I mean, it is so fascinating, and sadly, we're losing what's on these tombstones. And there's markings. We talked about this when we talked about Celtic art. I mean, there's certain crosses that mean certain things. The symbolism or symbolism, depending on what country you're from, is fascinating. But anyway, see, I'll go on a whole tangent. I think, well, because I'm going to graveyards, I learned about people I didn't know about. Like, famous historic people that I didn't know about in history,
When my mom died, she lived with us here in Silver City, and when she passed away, we had her cremated. However, we went to the cemetery because there's an area where you can put plaques up of people who died. Well, anyway, she is in, I guess, sort of interred in a rose garden,
Oh,
taken
nice.
care of by the gardening club here in Silver City. And the person that it's a small cemetery, but Billy the Kid's mother is there.
See, that's cool.
Yeah,
Oh,
it is.
I remember your mom.
So,
She was a gentle
yeah.
soul. And I remember her having like a little beer in the afternoon, like, she
Oh,
liked,
yeah.
she was, he was, she was a little live wire, and just had a, she had
Yeah,
a
she
good
was.
soul. I remember her very well, Nancy and I, and you've painted her too. I still,
Yeah.
yeah, you had the whisk, the beaters in her painting. Okay, that's a whole other
It was.
yes.
Yeah, she was my model toward the end. Yeah, so.
People must always ask you about that. Like, why do you have beaters next to your mom in a painting?
Well, actually, that painting was, there was a cat. I did a cat painting with beaters in it too.
Right?
Yeah. So anyway, well,
That's
oh gosh,
everybody,
well,
Victoria's, contemporary figurative artist. And when you go, there's cat, a lot of cats, there's horses, there's all kinds of things that she paints. And it's whatever moves you. It's your art. And I love your art. Nancy does too. And I know a lot of people that do. And you've got the motion down 100%, whether it's a human, a cat, a beater, you have the motion and the movement. You understand those little glimpses. And I always just think that's just a one observant person and then knows how to put it out there for the world in art. We really appreciate it. So, everyone, victoriachick.com is the website to keep up with Victoria. Her article on the art of engraving is up on blendradioandtv.com. All the links are in the show notes, as always. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Victoria. It's always a fun conversation. We always go down other roads, which we love. So I think our next conversation has to be graveyards. I really think so. We'll do something. We'll do
Okay.
a special. I'll bring family history people on too. We'll do like a special graveyard show. I got people. I got graveyard people. Like, that's a weird thing to say.
Lisa, I am writing graveyard down here in my notebook, so I
Wow, that's
remember.
great. You're going to wake up in the morning
Okay.
and go, "What was that? What was that dream?" Ah,
Yeah.
thanks so much, Victoria. You take care.
Okay. Thanks, Lisa. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Big Blend Radio. You can view Victoria Chick's artwork at victoriachick.com. Keep up with us at bigblendradio.com.